Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to audio and video content, episode archives, monthly roundtables, a book club, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with a dollar a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show. Today, the sun will set at 8:03 p.m. It's my favorite time of year. In the evenings, when I walk my dog, if it's cool enough in the afternoon, I can see both the sun and the moon in the sky at the same time. If you follow me on social media, you know that I am absolutely a summer child. I might have been born in April, but I come alive at the time of year when the sun rises early and the sun sets very late, and you can wander outside as often and as much as you want. It's like this time of year just like calls to you, begging you to come explore the forests and travel along rivers and creeks and climb mountains. It wants to be explored. I don't know, maybe that's just me. I live up in the frozen north of Chicago. It's very cold and overcast and wet and snowy most of the year. So when it comes time that we can finally go outside, I want to spend as much time doing that as possible. But there's a difference, right, in going outside to, I don't know, walk the sidewalk or wander around a local park, or even if you're in a more rural area, you know, wandering a field or forest nearby, and really going to explore the outdoors, camping, hiking, going out away from people, away from the safety and clutches of society, and getting out to where it seems like you are traveling back in time to find areas that have sort of been frozen in time that aren't really, or at least seem to us, to be touched by man. To go out and experience those properly takes money, it takes access, it takes preparation, it takes work, and according to my guest today, it takes a little suffering as well. Diana Helmuth is the author of the book How to Suffer Outside. It's an entertaining, often very funny guide for beginner backpackers and hikers to kind of know what they're getting into before they wander into the great outdoors. If you're someone that also likes getting back to nature whenever possible, this interview is for you. Diana Helmuth, welcome to Head on Fire.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm so glad to have you here. You know, I am looking out my window at one of the first warm, like legitimately warm days of the year. It's like in the upper 80s. According to my watch here, it says it's 88 degrees Fahrenheit outside. It makes me want to go outside. And I know that with this time of year, a lot of people are having the same feelings. And I thought, you know, let's have a conversation about going outside. You literally wrote the book, How to Suffer Outside. I am one of the weirdo people that wants to go outdoors, and you wrote about it.
I did. I tried.
So tell folks a little bit about yourself, your entryway into writing about the great outdoors, camping, and all of that good stuff.
Sure. So I got started in, describe how I got the idea to write the book, because I think that's more interesting. So when I was 19, I was doing a lot of backpacking with a good friend of mine named Jeannie. I write about her in the book a lot. She's kind of like, it's sort of an advice book, but it's also nonfiction, and she's a recurring character. She is the Frodo to my Samwise. And we were hiking in the Paria Canyon in Arizona, which is a slot canyon that feeds into the Grand Canyon. Very beautiful. You're hiking deep between these, you know, amber red sandstone colored walls. Sometimes they get so narrow you're going shoulder to shoulder and wiggling. Sometimes they open up really wide. It's very surreal. It's very cool. And we were walking through there, and we were, according to the Marine who stopped us, lost. Jeannie had worn the incorrect shoes. She had at least 20 blisters on her feet combined. She was in absolute agony I stepped into quicksand, and then I think one of us fell. Like all of this happened kind of at the same time, and we just collapsed in this wet sand, and we were all alone, and we just started laughing hysterically, like that apocalyptic end of the world laughter that you get when you just realize you are a victim of fate, and how could you ever have the illusion that you ever had control over anything? It's almost freeing. And at that point, I turned to her. I don't remember if I turned to her or she turned to me. One of us said, "We should really write a book about how to go backpacking so that the world, the poor masses, can benefit from our expertise." And that is the origin story of the book. I've learned more about backpacking since then, but to make a longer story short, what I was trying to get at with this book is I feel like sometimes in a lot of nature writing and a lot of social media on nature, this is starting to change, but the prevailing image is of someone who is successful, who doesn't smell bad, who knows what they're doing already because someone came with a magic wand and just booped all the information into their head. You don't see the blisters. You don't see the tears. You don't see the, "Oh shit, I'm lost." It's just them on a mountaintop with their arms in the air, topless, going woo. And that's like 10% of it, right? But the other 90% is just pure and total suffering. And I wanted to write like a permission slip to the world that I wish I had read when I was first getting into backpacking. That was more or less, it's okay. You're going to screw this up a lot. And by the way, when you're screwing it up, it doesn't mean what you're doing is wrong. Like that's a normal part of the journey. So don't let anyone make you feel like that you have screwed up means you don't belong here, that you're suffering means you don't belong here. You do. Obviously there's a lot to be learned, but you're doing great, sweetie. Don't worry about it. That's the tone.
Yeah, a lot of social media accounts that their following is sort of based on people that want to see videos of being outside, being on those hikes. You know, there's that guy who's like, "Hey, want to go on an adventure with
I
me and my
love him.
mustache?"
I
Yeah,
love
who
him
doesn't love
so
him? He's
much.
hot. Yeah, and he seems to be a professional hiker, so good for him. But you know, you see, even in his videos, because it's like 60 seconds, so you only really see the highlights. You see the high points. You do see that, you know, that shot at the end. He's on the top of the mountain, and he took you along with him. You saw a couple of the steps, but you didn't see the suffering to get there. Every now and then, he'll put up a video where it's like, "Oh, here's what actually happened. Here's how I almost broke my camera. Here's how I did this or this or this." So, what is it about that the journey of the backpacking, the actual suffering outside bit? That so intrigues you and that makes you think other people should do this, definitely.
I mean that's an eternal question. Why do we climb the mountain, right? Why do we go into nature to hurt ourselves and come back and tell other people we did it? And I recently had a conversation with Rue Mapp and Sylvia Vasquez Lovato and Lauren Delaney Miller about this at the Bay Area Book Festival, and we were talking about how our relationship to nature has changed over time. And I think when you first start, it's very, nature is a masculinity proving ground, for lack of a better term. You go out there to see how much you can take. You go out there to test yourself. And that is, was, probably still is, if I'm being honest with myself, a little bit, but I'm trying to change it. And an approach to nature, it's very masochistic. I make a lot of masochism jokes in the book, like a lot of them. Like, is this whole thing just my own repressed masochism? Is that what this hobby is? But people talk a lot about type two fun, delayed gratification. I think that's a huge factor. But what I have noticed is, rather than feeling like nature is a place I have to go to prove myself, nature is a place where I can go to simply appreciate it. Because nature's gonna kick your ass kind of no matter what. Like it's like you don't need to go looking for the fight. Like it's coming. Just don't even worry about it. And I think it's better to not think of it as a fight, but there's of course the idea that oh, I'm trying to remember who said this and I'm blanking. Oh, okay. I feel bad about this, but there's a beautiful quote by someone more profound than me that says, "The only Zen at the top of the mountain is the Zen you bring up there." So all of the peace and serenity you can find in Yosemite, in Kings Canyon, in the Ansel Adams Wilderness, on the Appalachian Trail is theoretically something you could find in your bedroom. But most of us don't know how to get there, and frankly, it's easier to go outside and get it and face the suffering of your insides and the outsides and engage with the metaphor and embrace masochism. And it makes for a great story. So, what's the harm, truly?
I think sometimes the reason why that, because I agree, but I think the reason sometimes why that is, the only Zen at the top of the mountain is what you bring with you, and that you had it all along, Dorothy, is because when we strip ourselves of our routines and we strip ourselves of our little daily triggers and our reminders of all the things that we're bad at and all the things that we're not doing and all the things that we're avoiding to go outside, it gives us a space to separate ourselves from our anxieties and our everything else's and focus on the fact that, oh, there I am.
There I am. I think that's really true. Sometimes you do need that. You need something to shatter your routine to see what you're like in a different environment. Yeah, I think that's completely true.
You said something that I thought was so interesting and I think is so true, that being outside, backpacking, et cetera, is a masculinity proving ground. And I think it's so interesting because when you picture a backpacker, when you picture hiking and going outside and all of that, it does feel very masculine in a very cisgender, heteronormative, white kind of, it feels like one of those spaces that feels very much like a very specific kind of person does it, and everybody else needs a qualifier. Like if I were going out, it's a gay backpacker or a female backpacker or this or that or whatever. And
Precisely,
it feels like one of those things where cisgender heterosexual white maleness is somehow the default in that setting. So I appreciate that you wrote this book and that you are such an advocate for people to go outside and make the outdoors theirs as well. Do you feel that, did you feel in getting into backpacking, did you feel that you were invited in? Do you feel that, folks who are seen as an other are invited into those spaces? And if not, are you seeing that change?
I think I sort of have two answers to that. So for my experience, the person who first got me into hiking and backpacking was my mother. And I also grew up in I basically grew up in a femme cult. Like I grew up in an entirely female house. Like men kind of came in sometimes, but like I never even listened to a man growing up. My mom was the authority, full stop. She was the hug and the shotgun. She was all of
Feel
it.
like a lot of people are going to be jealous of you right now.
Right. She's a very cool lady. I like my mom a lot. But and then I did more backpacking in high school through a program called TEAM, which I read about in the book. This was a truly amazing experience, very unique to, I think, the county I grew up in, which happened to be very wealthy. We were not a wealthy family, but I grew up in a very wealthy area. And when you grow up in a wealthy area, you get to do things like take your junior year, and instead of going to normal high school, you go to a program called TEAM, where it's you and 24 kids and two teachers, and you do your quote unquote normal classes, but you also spend all Tuesday going to a literal internship instead of school, and you go on three backpacking trips, and they teach you wilderness medicine. And it was the coolest thing I've ever done. I feel so grateful that that happened. It was free. This was not like outward bound. I mean, this was free. The county paid for the majority of it. And so I was invited in there, and half the people in that class were girls, and half of our leaders were girls or women. And so it didn't occur to me that being female wasn't the norm until I encountered other backpackers on the trail. And a lot of the time, I was patronized, I was talked down to. I've learned to just sort of tune those guys out. It's not everybody, but they're still out there. And the thing is, if I'm really, really like trying to find my most empathetic and best self, I think they mean well. I think they're just trying to like help me out and protect me by trying to explain to me how my own tent works or whatever. But so I just kind of try to just let it roll off me. I'm like, okay, thanks, fake dad. You'd have a good hike, but I'm fine. Thank you. Goodbye. Anyway, so it didn't occur to me that being a woman was like a repressed group outside. And even now, sometimes when I go hiking, I feel like I see more women than men rather than equal. With that said, when I was just on this panel over the weekend at the Bay Area Book Festival called Women in the Wild, and I remember thinking, I was joking with the two other women on the panel. One was a mountaineer and the other was a rock climber. And I said, you know, don't you think this is a little funny? Because aren't women actually the majority now? And they both looked at me and they said, no, not in our fields. We have to deal with a lot of shit. And I went, oh. And, you know, mountaineering is a little more specific. You're doing peaks that are over 14,000 feet. It's a different skill set than just good old fashioned backpacking, high elevation or not. And rock climbing, I think, is still very male dominated. But at the end of the panel, this woman stood up, this like 85-year-old woman stood up in the crowd and said, when she was teaching women to hike in the 1950s. And at the time, no, the women didn't want to learn how to use their bodies outside. They were afraid that they would get strong and men wouldn't want to date them. And when they did go for it, men didn't take them seriously. I mean, they faced a ton of barriers. And she looked at me and she said, it's so great to see these athletes. And it was the first time in my life two things happened. I thought of myself as an athlete, which I never have. And I realized I was the beneficiary of this massive lineage of women who had worked their asses off so that I could go under the trail and be like, women are normal, right? Like, it was very good for me to sort of respect my heritage. And to answer the second part of your question, I think I'm white. And I know that there is... I mean, I've heard a lot of jokes about how camping and hiking is like a white person thing. And, you know, why are you paying to be homeless? And, you know, that's Guayanacas or whatever. Like, it's all that's a white person thing. And there are a lot of historical precedents for that. I mean, traditionally in the wilderness, that's not a safe place for Black people in this country. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a lot of activists out there who I'm mostly just trying to point to and amplify who are trying to change that, like the group Outdoor Afro, She Colors Nature. Those are two people that come immediately to mind that are queen work, that are three people. There's zillions more. That's just off the top of my head. But these are Black women who are basically standing up and going, we're outside. It is for us. Let's change the narrative. Let's show Black joy outside. I think that's magnificent, and my hope is as time goes on, that tone shift will just change and this won't be considered like a white person's hobby anymore. Yeah.
Let's talk about access, because something that you brought up made me sort of chuckle a bit. So I live in the suburbs of Chicago, and when I work downtown, people... And I tell people where I live, they act like I live in a far off land. So they're very concerned about like my access to water and basic essentials. They're like, do you all get electricity all the way out there? So bad. Like, you know, it takes me less time to get to this office than you do, right? Like, I have a direct line here and you've got to take like, you know, 30 different trains or whatever to get to the office. But it's so interesting because when you live in a city environment, when you live sort of disconnected from nature, and a lot of people do, you know, cities have millions and millions of people in them that are, you know, inherently sort of disconnected from nature. You might get a park, right. But being able to go backpack, being able to go actually like go out into the wild of nature, there's an accessibility issue there. And inherently, mm-hmm. of course, there's a conversation of privilege to be had anytime there's a conversation of accessibility. But what maybe resources do people have that they don't realize, or how could people engage with backpacking, hiking, you know, that kind of thing whenever they may not have access or think they don't have access?
Right. I think that's a fantastic question. I think it depends on the barrier. I mean, if you're afraid to go alone, especially if you're like, I mean, I'm still afraid to go alone, you know, and I wrote a book on this stuff. Plenty of women backpack alone. I'll hike alone, but I'm still too chicken to do an overnight by myself. I'm not afraid of bears. I'm afraid of people. Your brain plays tricks on you in the night in the forest, man. Every little crunch is a, anyway. I think there are lots of groups you can connect with, like Women Who Hike, again, Outdoor Afro, Brown People Camping. Like, there are a lot of groups of people who are unlikely hikers is a huge one. You know, people who look like me, whether you're plus size, whether you're non-white, whether you have some kind of physical handicap that makes you move a little differently through the world than someone who doesn't. I think for me, one of the biggest things I think about is money. Backpacking can be a very expensive sport. It can also be a cheap sport. You just have to be more careful because cheap gear can get you into trouble. But there's also a lot of gear rental programs. And the truth is, backpackers are the nicest people on earth. I mean, if you ask to borrow gear 95% of the time, they'll just go, yeah, just like bring it back. And then you have to bring it back. There's like a circle of trust. But the backpackers, like I am like not a nice person in my daily life, but on the trail I have literally given someone the pants I was wearing, you know, like that's, I'm like, who is this? But why is she so nice? I'm like such a bitch in real life. I don't really know.
And then
why.
As you're walking back half naked to your car, you're like, I need to have a conversation with nice me. That bitch.
I mean, I wore my long underwear, my pajama pants, so I wasn't totally naked. But yeah, I think there's, within the backpacking community, for the most part, I think people are kind, possibly because we're all reminded of back when human used to have to team up to fight nature to do anything. Mm. We all had to like battle saber-toothed tigers in caves. I don't know. I'm completely making that up. But for some reason, backpackers are just really nice to each other. So I think if you're looking for a way to get in, you know, there are lots of groups that exist that can help you connect with people who are like you. If you mm-hmm. feel like you're not the quote unquote normal hiker, you probably are. And there's groups out there that can help affirm that for you. And I think in terms of money, borrowing gear rental programs at REI and I want to say Big Five, they like low key run the biggest gear rental program in the United States and just no one ever talks about them. Oh my God, I feel so bad. I can't remember if it's Big Five or Sports Basement. It's one of the two and I wrote about it in my book, but, and then finally, on the one hand, accessibility is great because I think the more people that go outside, the more people appreciate nature, the more likely they are to vote for climate change initiatives. Like it has these huge trickle-down effects. I think the more people go outside and clog the parks and piss everyone off, the more parks we're probably going to get. It's just a growing pain. So I'm always a fan of more people going outside. With that said, I have definitely been in a traffic jam in the Yosemite Valley floor going down Highway 1 in Big Sur, just wishing I could literally make everyone in front of me evaporate so I could be with nature alone. But learning to share the outdoors is a really big part of being a graceful backpacker, I think. Yeah.
Let's talk about being a graceful backpacker. You know, I've seen a lot of your social media and you are incredibly conscious of your impact and of educating others on being good stewards of the trail. What do people need to know before they go take their first hike?
What a fantastic question. It doesn't biodegrade. Whatever you think biodegrades, doesn't. That's something I want to scream from the rooftops. The only thing that really drives me crazy about crowds, and you understand why some people get this attitude where they think, you know, don't tell people about my trail, or I'm not going to tell you where I hike because I don't want you to ruin it, it's this nature is mine attitude that normally I scoff at, but then you go hiking and you see little like tufts of toilet paper caught up in branches and orange peels on the side of the road, and you're like, this is why we can't have nice things, guys. This is why we can't have nice things. So I think the idea that everything you bring in you have to bring out is something that is oft repeated. I would like to acknowledge openly how disgusting that can truly be. I don't want to pack out used toilet paper. That's fucking nasty, man. But you bring a little bag for trash in your hiking bag, bring hand sanitizer, you know, it can be done in a very non-disgusting way. It's conceptually disgusting, but packing out all of your trash, you'll win brownie points with the Lorax. You'll go to heaven. I don't know, whatever bait you need, you know, but like you'll earn all the good karma. That is the thing I really want to drive home the most, because as long as we all do that, what you're doing is like when you walk into a pristine wilderness that looks like it's frozen in time from the year 500, the year 1000, the year 1500, and it looks like it's been that way forever and it's just for you, like you've gone back to this beautiful primordial earth temple, that is an illusion that has been given to you by the work of countless nonprofits, tons of governmental legislation, and a lot of people who have just picked up their trash. And all you have to do is pick up your trash and you can give it to someone else. That's all you have to do. So always bring something to put trash in your pack. I guess that's the short answer to that question. Yeah.
You know, there are some folks that wanted to ask, what about my small child? How do I bring my small child? And what about myself and my old arthritic knees? So, so how do the very young or folks with disability or folks that just happen to be a little bit older than the rest of us, can those folks, those groups of people interact with backpacking and hiking?
Yeah, I think, well, with full disclosure, I am not a parent, so I can't speak from personal experience too much to the kid thing other than to say, I hear they're making cool backpacks now that allow you to like put your kid on your back and then you can hike with them. I don't know how you would deal with diapers in the wilderness. I know that people do deal with them. I think it might
cloth
be
diapers. Just to pack it in. I mean, you know, bring something you can wash.
Yeah, cloth diapers. Yeah, or pack them all out. Although I think that would get really bulky over time.
I loved your TikTok video where you were like, people like put the diapers or the whatever in the jar or something. And you were like, that's a bomb, baby.
Oh, yeah. Oh my God. Right. No, this woman told
might
me.
Might be my favorite piece
about
of media of yours ever.
Yeah. I was talking about Leave No Trace. And this woman commented, she said, you know, I go hiking with my dog and I have to pick up his number two and, you know, obviously use the little doggy wag bags. And then she says she puts them in a glass jar to keep them from getting smooched in her backpack while she hikes. And of course, from smelling, which is a genius idea. But I just thought about that conceptually and I was like, that's also a bomb. That's something you could dominate a village with that kind of weaponry. So that's a method. Yeah. But I think... yeah, I wish I could speak more to little kids. I might just have to defer to better voices. Tons of people do it. I don't know the details, unfortunately. But for arthritic knees, I can definitely talk about that. I am a huge fan of trekking poles. And also, I mean, there are lots... the beautiful thing about the internet now is that you can just look up about any trail in the world. So if you know in your heart you are not super good at hills, because when you go downhill, your knees scream. First, there's the hurdle of self-acceptance. Like, hiking is still for me, even though I can't go downhill all the time. It's like, that's okay. Not everything is Everest. Like, there's lots of gray area here between your backyard and the Himalayas. So let's go find it. But, you know, I'm not a particularly huge fan of all trails, but they are a good resource. There's also Hiking Project. There's, well, that's sort of specific to California and Oregon. Often within states, people will have banded together to create crowdsourced hiking routes and reviews of them, and people can kind of post trail conditions, and everything should be taken with a grain of salt. Always carry the 10 essentials with you. Conditions change all the time. That's part of the fun of nature, is you never know quite what you're going to get. But you can definitely just go outside and hike flat with poles. You don't always have to tackle a hill. And your adventure is completely valid, by the way, because you're not here to conquer anything. The suffering's going to happen whether you want it to or not. So like, don't worry about that. But I think the biggest thing I would say to those people is nature's still for you if you want some. It can absolutely be found. You just need to be more careful about the trails you pick. Yeah.
I had another person who wanted to ask, are there any animals I can put in the woods with minimal risk to myself or the animal? Pet in the woods. Are there any animals I can pet in the woods with minimal risk to myself or the animal? They do admit that this is a half joke, but I do think that this brings up a very good topic about interacting with wildlife while you are in their house.
Right. There's actually, I will recommend a really wonderful book by Rachel Levin called Look Big that discusses this precise topic. But I think my answer to that's going to be just no, just like hard no. When you're in nature, you don't want to touch the animals. You especially don't want to touch the ones who seem like they want to touch you, because that means something's probably really wrong with them. Rabies is real. You don't want to have to find out you just got bit by something that may or may not have rabies while you're, 4 days away from the trailhead and can't get your shots immediately. Oh my God, the thought of that scares me so much. I wish I could say that the last time I was in Kings Canyon, I saw a little baby bear and we snuggled in my sleeping bag and he blew me a kiss and now we're best friends and I can't wait to see him this year. But I did see a baby bear and my blood ran cold because I thought,
there's a bigger bear somewhere.
Oh my God. Where's your mom? Everything was fine. She was not between her and her cub, so all was good. But nature is to be seen, not touched, I guess. That's what we save our beautiful pets for. I wish I had a better answer than that, but it's just the sad truth. Yeah.
No, I think I grew up in Texas, the land of, hold my beer, watch this. And right. I just can't tell you the number of people that think they're going to be the person to play with the snake and it not bite them. They're going to be the person to go poke that, literally go poke the bear, and and it be a funny video or a cute story that they tell. And I'm like, you are not the guy, my guy. You Mm-mm. just aren't. You are not. And yeah. Neither are any of your friends. Like,
yeah.
Also just don't.
I think maybe it goes back to that masculinity proving ground thing. Like, if mm-hmm. I can pet it, it means I have dominated it. And like, no, just leave it alone. Just, you're an animal too. They're an animal. Watch each other like you're two animals and ignore each other, which is usually what animals do. Unless they're killing each other. That's usually the only time that they touch. Yeah.
Okay. I have a very selfish question for you. And this is going to inform just our friendship and our relationship forever. Oh, so no, this is important for you to get right.
Oh, God.
Am I still camping? Okay. So there's layers to this. Am I still doing camping if I bring one of those big tents? No, I've got layers. I told you there's layers. You have to take this seriously.
Go, go, go. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so am I still doing a camping if I bring like a big tent, okay, and I've got one of those like inflatable sofas,
mm-hmm.
and there's like a table and a TV situation, maybe a switch, and I also bring like an inflatable king-size bed with a pillow top on top and like full bedding and like a little hangy light for my big tent. Am I still doing a camping then?
Is there also a French press?
Obviously.
Okay, good. Just check.
Yes, or at clearly.
Least a pour over. I mean, at least.
Ma'am, me and coffee. Like, if I have not been caffeinated, people die. So, yeah. Yes.
Okay. Yes, you have done a camping.
Yes. Okay. End of question. Okay.
Well, no, I mean, if I can elaborate on that a little bit, this is something that I've been thinking about a lot lately. I'm currently writing a book about witchcraft, which we may or may not talk about lately, but this is an organic segue into it. And it has changed how I think about my relationship to nature. And I was sort of talking about this earlier, but when I was younger, whenever I would go backpacking or even day hiking or even camping, my poor friends, because I would just subject them to my like merciless monkish attitudes, this asceticism, this completely unnecessary idea that the level of my suffering informed the value of my journey into nature. And I have been letting that go, I want to say, I think very slowly over the course of 5 to 10 years. And I'm at a point now where I'm like, I like putting everything on my back and going into these places in the wilderness that feel like fewer people have seen them, that feel sacred, that feel less touched. I can't shake the feeling that feels very, very special. At the same time, I have had moments outside sitting under a plum tree in my backyard that have felt profound and magical, and like the green is talking to me and shit. And so, you know what? If you go camping and you bring your luxury tent and your blow up mattress and your pour over, I think that's fine. I think the key is if you're going outside and communing with the plants, however you would like to do that, I think that makes you and the earth and the future generations all better. So great stuff. Have at it. There's nothing wrong with being comfortable outside.
It's just your advice from earlier. If you take it with you, that does mean you have to pack it back up and take it back.
Also,
That's
yes, that's
it.
very key. Yeah.
That's all. Take as much stuff as you want with you. Just make sure it leaves with you as well.
And sometimes bringing your whole glamping apartment, I have found it's like when it takes 6 hours to set it up and 6 hours to tear it down. Because I glamp. I mean, I've like at the end of that process, though, I'm like, man, I wish I had just brought a tent and a sleeping bag and a bunch of packets of the ramen just so this could be done. But you know, when you're glamping, you feel like royalty. It's the best. It's fun. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. For sure, for sure. I will say it's been many a year since I've camped. I think my last time camping, I was up in West Virginia, and my family's from there. And waking up next to the pond and your sleeping bag, and it's kind of chilly because it's just a tent and there's no insulation and all of that. It's beautiful, it's magical, it's wonderful. You're away from everyone, your feet away from where your ancestors had a home and they're buried, and it's a lovely, beautiful experience. And I will tell you, looking back on it, I think, gosh, that was just a cherished, wonderful memory that I'm so glad that I have. But it would have improved if I had an inflatable mattress.
A lot of my
There's
time
nothing about that
outside.
experience that I couldn't have had with an inflatable mattress, is all I'm saying.
A lot of my
I
time
don't I don't
outside could
want
have
to
been
sleep
spent.
on the ground. I don't want to.
I
I
wish I had
don't
learned that earlier. I really do. I really
want.
do.
And I can go be in the mountains, and I can go make the green things talk to me or whatever, and still not have back pain.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, especially as you get older, like I'm
You
only in
just
my
call me
thirties,
old.
but I don't hike like I did when I was 18. I mean, even like I'm still relatively young, but just like even I'm like, oh.
Why be miserable if you don't have to?
Yeah. Like it goes back to that whole the suffering's coming no matter what. So like prepare your comforts as you can. It's fine. You know, you're not less because you have the inflatable pillow. It's fine.
Okay, but I do have some folks that do have some questions
Okay.
about overpacking. So even though I am probably a maximalist when it comes to packing, what are your tips for folks that are on the opposite end of that spectrum for whatever their personal reasons are, reasons I cannot begin to fathom.
Right.
But for folks that don't want to take much with them, what do you recommend being in their bags? What do you recommend being in their trunks as they head out into the wilderness?
Great question. I do have a packing list in How to Suffer Outside that I spent a really long time thinking about, and it is everything I put in my pack, kind of depending on whether I'm going somewhere that's wet and cold versus hot and dry. But I think, you know, Coco Chanel said, take one thing off. That's always a good motto. the art of backpacking truly is packing your pack and finding, do I have everything I'll need rather than packing things that I think I'll need but won't? Or, oh God, if I leave that thing behind, am I going to need it? But then I won't. And then I've wasted all this space. Maybe, did I say that right? Whatever. I think people know what I'm trying to say. I think you can probably cut down on more toiletries than you think you can. All you really need is like band-aids, duct tape, and some kind of multi-purpose lotion that you can put on like your face and your feet and everything. I'm a fan of
Can
Amish
we go back to the duct tape
B&W.
for just 1 second? I'm sorry. Are we burying bodies or something? What's duct tape?
Oh no, we're not bearing. No.
Duct
Duct
tape
tape
is
is
a
duct
tarp
tape.
on the list as well.
Sometimes.
Not going
And a
camping with
knife.
you, Diana.
A knife
Or
and duct
maybe I
tape and a tarp.
am.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll fill the tarp first.
Good time in the woods. Duct tape or gaffer tape, which I'm particularly a fan of, can be used to, you can put it on a blister, you can use it to repair your clothing. I have worn shoes that have been strapped back together with duct tape. You can repair your pack. You can patch a hole in your tent in a pinch. It is this all-purpose put it back together stuff. And I think
It's magic.
it's magic. Yeah.
The
Like you.
magic spell in a roll you can get for a dollar.
It's the magic glue in your bag of holding. That's, yeah, duct tape is, or gaffer tape, which I like more because I think it's easier on the skin, but you have
Is
to
that
get
the
a really high
shiny
quality
one?
one.
Is that the
It's,
really
yeah, it's
shiny
like
one?
electrician's tape. But you have to get the really expensive kind, and duct tape tends to be cheaper. Duct tape is just tougher on your skin. So if you have the money, get high quality gaffer tape. If you don't, just get duct tape. You can use it for
Well, if you
what
have the
you
money,
need.
get indestructible camping materials.
Also that.
Get
Just,
vibranium backpacks or
yeah,
whatever.
just buy the mithril everything at REI. I think practice packing your pack. Let's see, other tips on cutting things down. I forego things like a camp chair, except the fact that you're going to be eating dehydrated everything. There's no fresh food. Everything is dehydrated. And to save space, like if you get packets of macaroni and cheese or some kind of dehydrated hamburger helper type thing, take it out of its box, put it in a Ziploc bag, compress the air out of it, put that in a food bag, that like saves freakish amounts of space. That's just one fun little tip. And I think there's a temptation to bring like 4,000 jackets. That's how I felt initially. And I think the truth is you need, like, if you're going somewhere where it gets really cold at night, like I like to hike in the high Sierras and it gets down into the 30s at night. And I mean, I go in the summer and it goes down to the 30s at night. I don't go in the winter. I'm not that hardcore. Snow camping is, you want to talk about masochism? Those guys are like self-harming vampires. I don't know. Their snow campers are insane. But you just need a long underwear top and a jacket, basically. And then everything else just depend on your sleeping bag to keep you warm. I've never used gloves. I should have a hat. I don't. I have a lot of hair, but I think I don't know. I could kind of randomly throw off a lot of these tips, but I think putting everything on. Some people have asked me, "What's your weight?" And some backpackers, not your body weight, but the weight of your pack. And backpackers get really, 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 really into this. Ultralight hikers aim for a sub 10 pound base pack weight before their water, which I find incredibly admirable. That is not my school of thought, so
My
I don't have
God,
a
that's like a
number.
pair of shoes.
I know. I'm like, how do you do? They're all rich, by the way. They're all rich. I
Oh,
don't
okay.
know.
Well, sure. I mean, if I can afford super expensive, I mean, really expensive stuff can be very lightweight. It will also never stop existing. It will
Precisely.
be on this planet long
Yeah.
after humanity is dead. So
There's a correlation between price and weight, and there's probably a joke about wealthy women being thin in there, but I can't quite find it. But you can't, like, there's a whole when you put your pack on, you should practice with it on, and I think you'll know whether or not you need to take things out or not. I did have a friend the first time she went out, she took a Maglite flashlight with her, and I was like, I don't want to tell you how to live your life. I just don't think that's a very good idea. And she was like, it just makes me feel safer. And then, you know, midway up, she was like, why did I do this? And I was like, bro, I have no idea. Why are you carrying a mag light? Like, you definitely need less than you think. So I guess that's the final thought on that. Yeah.
What has hiking and backpacking, what has that given you?
Oh my God.
What's changed about you since you started?
I do think it improves your self-confidence.
Hmm.
I mean, I'm.
Is it because of that masculinity proving ground thing?
I'm so afraid.
Are we currently
it is.
Unpacking this with our therapist about like I know, it's I don't a bad give thing, it to but that, also but it did good things for me?
You might be right. I think because when you are out there. The whole idea of the Zen at the top of the mountain being the Zen you bring up there is you're still you. Mm-hmm. I would go backpacking when I felt like I needed to run away from something.
Mm.
Because I wanted to run away from my life. And hiking was a way to do that while everyone like really thought you were admirable. You know, I was like, I'm just trying to escape my problems, but everyone's like, oh my God, you're so brave. It's like perfect, right? Okay. But then when you're out there, you're alone with your thoughts and your feet and the trees, and that's it. And you have to face a lot of shit in yourself that you might not entirely like. You're kind of alone with your own thoughts, and you sort of have to sort through your own shit. It's very much, you know, the inner quest. The outer quest is a metaphor for the inner quest. And then you come back out and, you know, it's harder. There's like this wonderful period of chill that exists for me, and then I sort of become my neurotic self again. But for at least, I like to think 2 to 3 weeks after I get back from backpacking, I'm really who I would like to be in the world. Mm. I'm a more relaxed person. I know what to take seriously. I know what to let go. I'm more focused. I'm less distracted. I'm less anxious. Maybe because I've been able to run away from all my problems. So who wouldn't feel that way? But at the same time, I think it has more to do with I've actually been doing nothing but facing my problems all by myself in the woods or, you know, with a friend. And then you come home and you just feel better after having done that. You feel like a calmer, better version of yourself. Yeah.
What's the story that when you tell other people about your time on the trail and you're telling it as a funny story, you're like, haha, this funny thing happened to me, and you tell that story to people and they say, and you want me to go out there,
right?
what's that story for you?
Oh God. Well, there's one in the book where I have a few answers to this. There's one in the book where I get lost on an active volcano with a couple friends, and we end up having to escape through the ex-dictator's land after running out of time. But that was, I mean, I'm fine, everyone's fine. It wasn't actually as scary as it sounds. I mean, when Jeannie tells this story, she's like, Diana's a wuss, we were never in that much trouble. But it sounds cooler when I talk about it, I think. But more to your point, I took my poor, innocent, patient, willing, kind, thoughtful boyfriend backpacking on one of his first trips in like 10 years. As part of research for the book, I was trying to just get in as many trips as I could because I thought that would be good for me. So we went down to Big Sur. I live in Oakland, California. Big Sur is like 2 hours away near Monterey. It's this beautiful natural area by the coast. And we were going to backpack kind of the sea to summit route. You go from near the ocean, you climb up through these beautiful misty meadows with wildflowers and rolling grasses and rattlesnakes, and then you get to the top of a hill, and then you kind of come back down. It's a little 2-day loop, and he's so excited. He trusts me so much that he just gets to enjoy this because I've got the map and the plan, and I looked up the route and everything. So what happened is, and let this be a lesson to you all, I read my topographic map wrong. There's a topographic map is a backpacker's map. I mean, other people use it, but in backpacking, it is the de facto style map that tells you elevation over miles, how much you're going up or down. And there are contour lines on the map that allow you to see distance and elevation. So between one line and another line, that's 100 feet, right? Up or down. And usually it's 100 feet. And in the map I had, I thought it was 100 feet. It was 300 feet. So everything I had planned was actually three times steeper than I had planned it. And I didn't realize that until day two, because I was on top of the mountain without water, on the verge of tears, going, why am I so out of shape? What is wrong? Why is this so hard? And then I looked at the map again and realized what I had done. And I was like, hey, sweetie, so the thing is, this route we planned that we're in now, that we're stuck on, that we can't get off the ride now, we're locked in, is three times harder than we thought it was going to be. And we went to a campsite that I heard was nice, and it ended up being through, and I'm not exaggerating, it was 2 miles. We were bushwhacking poison oak for 2 full miles. Which is how I found out I'm not allergic to poison oak, because I thought there's no way in hell we're not going to get, I mean, we tried initially, you know, you sidestep, you do this, you do that, but this trail was so overgrown, and eventually we just, there was no choice. We had to push it out of the way. So we were like, okay, well, hopefully it just doesn't take effect until we get home. And then magically neither one of us got poison oak, which is sort of how I found out I don't get allergic to poison oak. Lucky me. Apparently it happens to a large swath of the population, but it's not something anyone ever tests. But anyway, on the way out, he ended up losing 2 toenails because it was steeper than we thought. And then, to make a long story short, we get back to the car and he's never gone backpacking with me
again. And he moved out the next day and you've never seen him again.
Actually, we were—
oh no, wait, that's why you have the tarp and the duct tape.
We were actually dating at the time. He moved in with me after that. What a real one, right? But
that's a keeper. Yeah, that's a keeper. Put a ring on that.
He tells me he's not mad about it. He tells me he's not harboring any resentment or guilt
through his teeth.
He's totally lying because he has refused to go backpacking with me ever since.
Lying through his toenails, which he has 2 less of. Like,
it was a long time ago. I've learned. I'm sorry. He's like, I know, and I'm not holding on to it.
Okay, so when you say a long time,
he still won't go.
How long is a long time?
I think this was in 2019.
That is not a long time, Diana.
Need more time to heal. Yeah.
That is 1 year pre-pandemic, which the pandemic doesn't count as time. So basically it was last year.
Mm-hmm.
Not a long time.
His toenails grew back. I mean, like, they're beautiful now. His feet look great, but yeah, I think the trust is shot.
Yeah.
The trust will never come back.
Yeah. Ouch.
Mm-hmm.
Ouch.
Is that the kind of story you wanted? Is that
awful? Did not know that was what I was gonna get. I think the toenails was the worst part for me.
Yeah.
Ooh. Okay. What are you working on now? I'm actually very curious about this project of yours.
I am working on a book right now, so I'm shifting gears a bit. How to Suffer Outside is an advice memoir humor book, and the book I'm writing right now is called Witch Year, working title. I'm thinking, actually, and probably on TikTok, I'm going to pitch some titles to people, so if anyone feels like following me on TikTok, please do.
Oh, your publicity team isn't just informing you which titles will work with the SEO?
I'm asking the public first. That's what I'm deciding to do.
I can say I was given a list. We did just like, you know, keyword mishmash soup. It
like
was
a generator.
Gross. Yeah. Oh yeah. It was nasty. It was like 6 months. The book was done and edited and done, and we still didn't have a final title for it.
That was for Dabblers, was, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh man. It's a great nasty. I mean, it's a really good title though. I think it's a perfect title. Can I ask?
Thank you. It was title like number 48. So
what was the can I ask what one of the runners up was?
Oh gosh. So let's see. So the title that sold the book was Ethical Dabbling. And that's what was on my contract, because I was like, well, I wanted to, because I wanted it to be a book more about, you know, the ethics of interacting and learning and how to, you know, use discernment and do good research, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought, you know, ethical dabbling. And sold the book, started writing the book, got several months in to the first draft being done. And my editor's like, okay, great. What do we think about the title? What are we thinking for the title? And I was like,
it has a title.
What do you mean? What do you mean?
Yeah.
What do you mean? That was the title. Right. So that's not going to be the title, because the editing team, I don't know, the whoever decides these things was like, oh, I don't want the word ethical anywhere on the cover at all. Cause it feels like finger wagging at people, and we don't want to do that. And then it just started becoming a freewheeling SEO chase to try to find keywords that could make marketing and publicity happy, but that didn't just sound like every other book about witchcraft that's come out in the last 20 years. Cause I mean, you know, zero shade on any other author, because I have now gone through this. There's a reason why every book about witchcraft is basically the same title. Like, they all have the same title. All the books about witchcraft have the same title. You know, pick a, it's a something witch, you know, the something witch or the something witch's guide to. Mm-hmm. And those are, that's every book. That's every witchcraft book.
I don't want to agree with you, but I agree with you completely.
Right. It's I mean, you know, the blue witch's guide to blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. The green witch's guide to yada, yada, yada. The psychic witch's guide to yada, yada, yada. The modern witch, you know.
We should make there's a generator. Like, this would be funny.
Right. There's like 10 or 15 words that make the algorithm happy. And every book is some combination of those. Mm-hmm. So we went through all of those, and we had settled on a title, and then they told me that they found a title that they liked. I was like, sure, fine, whatever. That's great. And then we found out that it was the title of another podcast, and I was like, okay. So then we changed it again, and then went on another like 2 month SEO spree. And finally, I think, Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft ended up being like a subtitle for a different title. And I was like, well, what if we just make that the title? My editor liked it. I liked it. And at the time, they were going through changes in leadership, and the person that hated my original title that set us off on all of these things was gone. Mm-hmm. So basically I probably could have gone back to like ethical dabbling or something and gotten it. But we went with this, and that was the title. And I said, I do not care. The book cover was done with the wrong title. My book cover, like looking when they were pitching the book cover, the original like arcs of it and stuff, it had the original old wrong title on it. Like, that's how far we were in the process without the title of the book.
Wow.
I know.
The ethical dabbler. I mean, it does describe, because you spend a lot of the book talking about ethics, which I liked.
Oh, there's an entire, either a chapter or a section I did call ethical dabbling, because I was like, I'm going to get that in this book somewhere.
Yeah.
I'm going to get that in here somewhere.
Yeah. Good for you. I mean, The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft is a good title, but you know, I would have liked Ethical
Dabbler. But it still fits that, the something guide to something. And I, you know, it's sort of like in fiction right now, every title is a blank of blank and blank.
Oh my God, I didn't think about that.
Every fiction title, right. Every single fiction title is a blank of blank and blank.
Mm-hmm.
And fill in the blank of city of roses and robots, mm-hmm. a sky of hopes and demons, a court of thorns. That's every title right now. Mm-hmm. And it's a trope. I guess it's a trope that sells because they're still doing the trope. So somebody in marketing somewhere must know what they're doing. So yeah, good luck. I hope that you do not go through the same SEO mess that all of the rest of us have to go through.
I'm sure the working title right now is Witch Year, which that's what I sold the book as, and I that's not the final title, I think.
Of course not. It never is.
But the subtitle.
Have you started having discussions about cover yet?
No, I'm still writing the dang thing. So.
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah.
It's definitely. I think we were trying to put it out I want to say summer 2023. So there's definitely like some
Oh,
time
wow.
there.
Okay. So you've
Yeah.
got some time. That's
But
good.
what I've, the subtitle was A Skeptic's Guide, or a guide. Oh my God. I'm like in the mindset now. One Skeptic's Quest to Find Spiritual Fulfillment Through Modern Witchcraft. Like I pitched it as The Year of Living Biblically by A.J. Jacobs, but for witchcraft, right? And I started my year, my honest year, a bit by accident, but basically right before Lunasa on, I think it was July 28th of 2021, and I'll be finishing July 28th, 2022. And I'm just trying to absorb as much information along the way. I am practicing meditation. I am practicing spell casting. I am trying to summon demons. I am trying to do all this stuff with, you know, I have a pantheon of authors who are guiding my quest. I am reading a lot. I'm reading The Dabbler's Guide, among many, many, many other books. And there's lots of ups, there's lots of downs, there's lots of self-doubt, there's lots of things I go into it not liking and discovering I do like. There's lots of things I go into it liking and discover I don't. Some stuff has stayed the same. I still have like really mixed feelings about crystals, and like I really have mixed feelings about ghosts, mostly because probably they scare me, so I'm just like leaning into that. I don't know, but anyway, I'm confronting a lot. I'm doing all of the, you know, kind of the eight big high holy neo-pagan holidays, and we'll see how it goes. But that's what I'm working on right now. It's been humbling, it's been terrifying. I'm hoping it will be funny. I'm billing it as a humor book, trying to make witchcraft funny. God help me. Goddess help me. Let's see how that goes. And yeah, as you know, I've talked to you before about different approaches and things to try and avoid and lean into. You've been,
yeah, I think helped, I think so. when done well, you know, we talk a lot about raising up the voices of new practitioners and making sure they feel seen and heard and centered in conversation, so that they know they're part of the community. And one of my favorite podcasts of all time was a show that hasn't been on in many years, but it was called The Pagan Hooligans. Mm-hmm. And it was this married couple that were just starting to have kids when they started their show. And it was just, we're new to this. This is new for us. We're wanting, same thing. We're mm-hmm. wanting to start studying, and we want to document our journey into studying. And it was a very non-ego driven, just come along with us. We're going to get stuff wrong. We're going to ask stupid questions. We're going to fumble, and we're going to invite you along with us. And it was the most charming, wonderful, well, good spirited thing. And it gave everyone so much joy. And the thing is that we haven't had that perspective in such a long time, and certainly nothing that I can think of in book form, because I think that we think of publishing, and I understand why, and I get it for a lot of reasons why, you know, we think of a published book as needing to be instructive. And if you are instructive, that means you have to have years and years of experience. But the thing is, there is something incredibly instructive about the new experience. There's something incredibly instructive about somebody who knows how to learn, coming into a new topic and taking new people along for that journey.
Yeah.
And I'm excited. I'm excited to hear your perspective. I'm excited because I haven't been new in so long. You know, I write for new people, and I hope that new people find value in what I put out. But the thing is, what's it like being a new person in 2021, 2022? I mean, when I started, social media was not a thing, you right. know? Right. The best we had were the six books on the New Age shelf at the back of the local bookstore, and that's everything that we had. So you are starting at a time when there is such a wealth of information, and all sorts of voices are at the table. And that was not present when I started. There were a lot of default settings and implicit biases that were programmed into my brain that aren't going to be programmed into yours, because you're starting at such a different time. And that's so exciting to see. What just, you know, I don't, I'm sure that we'll have you back at We, like there's a team, like I've got a team.
No, let's pretend.
Hey, Jimothy.
There's a team. I have a team.
There's a team. I'm a whole team.
You have a team and we're very important people. Yeah.
I'm sure that, you know, you'll come back on whenever, I hope you'll come back on whenever your book comes out.
I hope too.
But I think it would be interesting to hear, you know, is there any particular thing that sort of surprised you along the way? Is there anything that you know, you want to tease maybe a little bit? Anything that you want to dribble out there for the listeners who might be interested to see your book come out?
Yeah, there's a few things I can think of. I mean, one of the things I struggle with the most in the book is this idea of, do I have to believe or not? Which is sort of crystallizing to me, possibly, you know, as the difference between being a witch and being a neo-pagan. You can be a neo-pagan and not believe in very much, but to be a witch, you really kind of have to believe in what you're doing. I think for it to work is that's where I am right now. If someone wants to have a conversation with me about how that's not the case, I'm very open to that. That's just where I think my reading has led me to believe that. So that has been a little bit of a challenge, is that you can't necessarily just go through the motions. Your heart really has to be in it. And also something we were chatting about this a little bit earlier. I initially got into witchcraft. I think the reason I started this journey, I mean, I'll be blunt. Lauren Parker at Love Magic Outlaw gave me the idea for this book, but I think the reason that it resonated with me is because in a world where we feel like we are constantly the victim of forces wildly outside of our control, witchcraft gives you the sense that maybe you do have a little more control through magic. And I have let that run away with me, with my brain. And I realized, I think I've been giving myself anxiety under the idea of, like, you know, my thoughts can control things. And so I need to be careful with my thoughts. And if I'm not careful with my thoughts, bad things will happen. Or if I do think something, then I have to do this to make sure it won't happen, which is not a healthy place to be mentally. And the idea that thoughts are spells got a little twisted in my brain. And I am currently working on how to use magic rather to embrace a sense of stoicism and realizing how to accept the things I can't control versus indulging the illusion that I can control everything, because when you're a witch, you can control everything. So that's something I'm kind of facing. But
That's such an interesting conversation, because once you start playing that out, you realize there are some boundaries. Mm-hmm. I mean, and once you realize that they're just by logic, there has to be some boundary here. Mm-hmm. You know, we are not literally jumping off the roof and flying. We are not right. literally conjuring fire with our minds. There's a lot that we aren't and cannot do.
Right.
So once you at least accept some limitations, you realize, okay, there are some boundaries here, but within these boundaries is an entire rich world of self-fulfillment, of spiritual fulfillment, mm-hmm. of belief, of, mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot to be had there, but, you know, just simply acknowledging that a boundary exists at all is yeah. hard for some people, because it, you know, you do bring up a great point whenever you say, you know, I wanted to reclaim that sense of control. And for many, they take that sense of needing control so far that they get very upset when you're like, okay, but not here.
Right.
But it doesn't go there.
Right.
It can't go there. You know, or if it does go here, what are the implications of that? You know, what does that mean for it to go there? You know, what's happening when you go there, et cetera, et cetera. And those are as banal as those conversations seem, as much as it seems like that would just be a place of objectivity, maybe for some folks, that's certainly going to be an interesting question, I think, to see you explore, because that's a big one for folks.
Yeah, And it's something I'm still, it this is an unfinished thought. I mean, this is something I literally wrote about this morning, so I have not come to any beautiful conclusions about it yet. But yeah, I mean, it's a journey. I've had moments where I'm on my bedroom floor crying because I think I'm going insane, and then I've had moments where I'm like meditating and I think I'm communing with the goddess Isis, and I literally felt like I was on MDMA. I mean, like actual ecstasy. So there's lots of ups and downs. Well,
It sounds like you're doing it right.
great. Glad to hear that. Doubt is a
It
huge part of the
sounds like a
process.
witchcraft journey to me.
There's a lot of doubt involved, which I thought was just my own personality, but the more I talk to witches, the more they're like, oh no, yeah, no, it's an absolute shit show. You're doing great. You're doing great, sweetie. I'm like, thanks. Wonderful. Okay.
And I think that's the thing, is that we don't want to put the doubt in the black and white. We talk to each other about our doubts. We're happy to have those conversations in person. We're happy to have those, at an event or a Pride Day or something like that. But when it comes to the books we write, there's no room for doubt. Absolutely none. There's no room for subjectivity. It is all objectively real at all. My perspective is objectively real at all times. Yeah, and I'm like, I think it's okay. It's okay to express the fact that we doubt. It's okay to express that sometimes, I was talking to Chawan Ku like a year or so ago. She describes herself as an atheist witch. And she says, "Do I believe in Hecate? Not most of the time when I'm doing rituals. Sometimes I get to a place of belief that some right then it's all real to me. It feels like belief. And then when I walk out of the circle, it goes back. And I think that it's okay if belief is a spectrum. And you can start your day on one place on the spectrum and be somewhere else on the spectrum at a different part of the day and go back to another part of the spectrum at the end. And some different parts of the year can have different places. And I think that should be okay. And we should talk about that more.
That's nice to hear. Because I feel like my whole book is just me doubt that the whole book is just doubt that we could just call the
Good.
book doubt,
Good. That's
witch
where a
doubt.
newbie should be. And you know what? If I were to write a book about camping,
Am I
it
doing
would
this
be
right?
not just how to suffer outside, it would be I am absolutely suffering outside.
Still
Diana
doubt. I
Helmuth,
mean,
thank you so much for being here on Head on Fire. The book is How to Suffer Outside. I am so glad that you're here. I truly appreciate your perspective, and I'm so excited to see where you go and where your voice will take us. Thanks so much for being here.
thank you. It's really, really great to be here. Thank you.
That's going to do it for this episode of Head on Fire. My thanks to my guest, Diana Helmuth, author of How to Suffer Outside, A Beginner's Guide to Hiking and Backpacking. Catch up with wherever Diana is at the time on her website at dianahelmuth.com. If you like Head on Fire and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. Share it with your friends on social media. You can also like or rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you download shows. And while you're there, leave a review. Reviews help recommend the show to other listeners just like you. Literally anything, a couple of emojis, some helpful words, I don't know, a knock-knock joke. Anything in the comment field helps bump up this show in the algorithm and make sure that it shares it with folks that listen to the things that you like. Help keep the show free and producing regularly by joining my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private Discord server, and a monthly book club. This month, we are reading Until I Am Free by Dr. Keisha Blaine. Sign up at patreon.com/headonfirepod. You can connect with me on most forms of social media. I am at Head on Fire Pod pretty much everywhere. That's going to wrap it up for this episode. I am also going to try to suffer outside a little bit today. I hope you are as well. But remember, if you're going to go outside, don't accidentally make a bomb. Bye now.